Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and I am joined once again by Katie Schaefer. Today we are talking all about Lisey's Story, the TV miniseries from Apple TV Plus, I think is the name of that streaming service. I get them all mixed up. It's either like Plus or Max or words that mean the same thing.
Yep.
Katie, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm excited to talk about this one. It's one of those, like, this might be getting ahead of ourselves, but it's one of those that's better than a lot of the stuff we've watched.
I was not surprised by the quality, because Apple doesn't necessarily do things halfway. They've kind of stopped caring about podcasts, though, it seems, so we just won't talk about that. But as far as, you know, from a production standpoint, if you just watch like their keynotes, they go all out on those things like WWDC and all this stuff. And, you know, they especially did that in 2020 because of the pandemic. They didn't have a live audience, and they did that for 2021 too, I think. They did one year or the other. It was something like that. And it was like this whole video production thing. So it did not surprise me that the quality and look of this show was really good. But what did surprise me, though, is how many people in this cast have been in other Stephen King things.
Yes. Yes. It's a lot of them.
Yeah. You know, Julianne Moore played Margaret White in the 2013 Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
You have Jennifer Jason Leigh, who was in Dolores Claiborne.
Oh, and so good in it, too.
Yes.
And she's just as good in this, I think.
And Joan Allen. So all three sisters were in previous things because Joan Allen was in A Good Marriage.
Oh, okay. One of the smaller ones.
Yes, smaller, but still, you know, notable enough. It had her and Anthony LaPaglia, and they were kind of the two big names in it. And I was just really impressed with sort of the dynamic of those three cast members, especially. And then you have Clive Owen, Dane DeHaan, Sung Kang, who, you know, comes to the same fate he comes to in Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, I haven't seen those movies, but now I know how he goes, and that's sad.
I mean, just in the fact that he ends up dead. But
right, you know. Right.
And in a, you know, in a car in this, it's like they knew. They were like, you and cars, it's a thing.
Yeah, you'll spend almost all of your time in this movie in the car, and then you'll die there. So, sorry, not a lot for you to do.
But even like the lesser focused on characters like Ron Cephas Jones as the professor, Omar Metwally as Dr. Hugh, you have Michael Pitt in these flashback moments to Scott's childhood. And I do want to say Dane DeHaan plays the unhinged character very, very well.
He really does. It is upsetting and totally hateful. And in the way of like, God, I really hate this character, but this actor is blowing it out of the water, like, because it's easy to separate that this is a character he's playing, because I've seen Dane DeHaan in several things, and this, I think, is his best performance I've seen him in. He really leans into the creepy facial expressions and the gross way that he eats. Ugh. And he's eating, like, almost all the time in the beginning of the show.
Yes.
It's just upsetting. It's like, oh, stop it. Stop putting those Cheetos in your mouth like that.
So much eating. And Julianne Moore, I think, does a very, very nice job as the lead, because this book is one that is so tough to read. And this is a very tough show to watch. It's not, you know, a good fun time by any means. It's not like watching It, for instance, which I talked about recently, where even though there are terrible things happening, you still feel good by the end of that movie. Whereas with this, you know, you have that triumphant ending, but because of everything that transpired before that, you're like, man, this is still rough.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Julianne Moore is like the perfect person to play Lisey, because she's about the right age, and they don't do a lot of makeup or whatever in this, so they allow her to look her age. And I mean, she still looks amazing, gorgeous, but because she's Julianne Moore. But she dresses like an older woman. She has that self-assurance, and it works so well for that character and felt very spot on. Like, from the first 10, 15 minutes where we see her, I was like, yes, this is... And I figured it would be great casting, but I was shocked at how well it does. Or how well she does, rather.
Yeah, and honestly, I thought Clive Owen was good, but kind of a weak spot in the show a little for me. It wasn't like he was giving some amazing, like, Emmy-worthy performance to me, but, you know, he's such a big name that I think he's one of those actors who just gets cast in these kinds of roles because of how he's going to play a specific character, and I think he definitely does that here, but I don't know, I guess I just kind of had a little bit of a different vibe from the book with Scott.
Scott comes across as very charismatic in the books. And I agree that Owen's performance in this is really toned down. He's very methodical and he has the same facial expression 75% of the time. And I think in this it worked for me because Scott is, in this, he's pushed a little bit more to the back in certain ways when mm-hmm. we're in the present, you know. They don't use nearly as much of him. And, you know, there's not nearly as many flashbacks to their marriage as there is in the book, mostly because the book is, you know, a book and very long. But he did feel a little too calm because, you know, there is kind of a manic energy to Scott in the books. And Clive Owen has none of that. Like in the scene where we see him freak out as an adult, where he goes and he's just sold his first book. He goes to the plate glass window and punches it in and then is just cutting himself. It was like, I feel like there should just be more expression going on. But I couldn't remember if in the book he acts that way. I could say it could be something where it was a director choice of like, no, I want you to really kind of like, because he's supposed to become catatonic. Like that's his risk in this book, is to become catatonic. So maybe that was a director choice as opposed to an actor choice. But I think he works really well as a support character for Lisey and Julianne Moore, because they were in Children of Men together.
Yeah, I think there just wasn't that little extra that I was expecting from his character in the charisma department, like you were saying. So, you know, that was where he kind of felt like a little bit of a weak spot, not too much, though. But I do have to admit, I was a little worried when I saw that King was writing the episodes.
Yes, I was worried, but hopeful, if you will.
Yeah, because this is a little different than him writing stuff specifically for TV. You know, this isn't like Kingdom Hospital, Rose Red, Golden Years, or even Storm of the Century. This is coming from source material that is very near and dear to him. He's said numerous times that Lisey's story is one of his favorite novels, and there's something a little more personal about it than the others. And I think that does come across in the show. But yeah, I was definitely a little worried. I was like, oh, I hope this isn't like those other things. Because Golden Years? Mm-mm.
Oh, so bad. So bad. Yeah, I think it worked in this instance precisely because of what you just said, that this is a very personal story. And he wrote every single episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is also a big difference because there's no writer's room. It's not like he's piecing it together and other people are doing parts of it. Because that would not have worked, I don't think, in this kind of story. So in this, it feels all of a piece. And the director for this was the director of Jackie, for those who saw that, starring Natalie Portman, which is about Jackie Kennedy, immediately during and after the assassination. That is a very traumatic experience movie. Not as in that's what you're watching. And Natalie Portman gives a very amazing performance. She was nominated for an Oscar for it. So for me, I kind of felt that hand of the director a little bit in guiding how this show was going to work. And so I'm thinking that probably contributed to Stephen King's teleplays, as I love that they called him that.
Yeah.
Working so well with this material and with the amazing actors they had who could, you know, all of them could act with a wet paper bag of a script.
Yeah, let's talk about the story a little more and the pacing, because this is a very slow burn. I think maybe if they had done 6 episodes, it would have been a little tighter. We maybe would have spent less time. I don't really want to say lingering on things, but a lot of the stuff from Scott's childhood felt like it could have been cut down because it seemed like we were kind of getting these same moments over and over again with his father.
Yeah, the early stuff especially.
Yeah.
I think. And it does that a lot in the books, but it's more because it's spending that time exploring little Scott's reactions to it, whereas you obviously can't do that the same way in a film medium.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have those parts because otherwise the story doesn't make sense. But yeah, there are. For me, I had kind of the same reaction of like, okay, this doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel nearly as urgent as it does in the books. And I don't know if that's because of the cinematography. I will say the cinematography in this is gorgeous and also way, way too dark. I watched some of this on my laptop and there were scenes where like I had to shut all of the lights off because otherwise I couldn't see what was going on. I would just see like this white blur of a face moving and it was like, well, what the hell is happening right now? So, and everything being really dark and gray because that is how it is for the most part in the Scott's childhood scenes does not contribute to speeding the pace up or makes things feel slower.
Yeah, and for me, it was like, how many times do we have to see the older brother chained up? Because we get numerous scenes of that, and you understand why you're getting them, but I do think they could have tightened this up and maybe cut it down 2 episodes. And, you know, maybe some of the episodes would have been a little longer, but there were just some lingering shots, too, where I was like, this looks lovely. Thank you for showing me this.
Yeah.
You showed it to me for a little too long. And I know we're kind of nitpicking here because I overall did enjoy this. But, you know, story-wise, it starts 2 years after Scott's death. And you see that people are still offering their condolences because, you know, they haven't seen Lisi in that 2-year time period. So she's not really getting to move forward with her life. And then you have this professor who wants Scott's unpublished works out in the world, and he wants the university to have them, and these people want them. And then, you know, you get Jim Dooley, who is the worst kind of fan, in my opinion. Yeah. It's like, great, I love that you love this stuff, but you are deciding who owns it.
Yes, like the examination in this of parasocial relationships between fans and creators, which for those who don't know, parasocial relationships refer to a one-sided relationship like listeners have with podcasts, for example. Like they don't know the podcaster on the other end of, you know, but a podcaster is in somebody's ears, you know, days and days and days. And so you feel like you know these people, but you really don't. And that's one of the things that's examined in the book. But I feel like in this, it's even more pushed upon, especially when it comes to the professor who has these like feelings of ownership and entitlement about Scott's work that are just disgusting. And then all of the things that both him and Jim Dooley say to Lisi, like, oh, you just warmed his bed. You were, you know, you were just his Yoko or whatever. And it's like, sir, do you think you know this person better than his wife of like 20 years? Because I guarantee you, you do not. You absolutely do not.
It was like he thought he knew Scott better than anyone else in the world and was also very misogynistic the entire time.
Yes. Yeah. And it's just gross. And Dane DeHaan pulls it off really well. And
I mostly know him as the Green Goblin, who I also don't like. So, you know,
I think the first one I watched with him was Valerian in the City of 1,000 Planets.
OK,
so which is a trashy, fun movie, bad movie, but he's fun in it. But I think this is such a personal and ripe story for King that the inclusion of that, especially because he's written a lot of books about writers, and from the stories he's told, I know he's experienced really crazy fans, and it fits so well within this narrative because the fear factor in this book is not, you know, I mean, the long boy is to a certain extent, but he is really the villain and the danger in this. And he is in no way supernatural. He's just a crazy obsessed person. In the same way that, like, in Rose Matter, this felt kind of similar to Rose Matter because the abusive husband isn't, you know, possessed or anything. He's just an abusive dickbag. So it works so well, and Dahan pulls it off. And I thought that the film version of it really does synthesize that in a very powerful way that the book kind of had a little bit of trouble doing.
One of the things that I was surprised by was the fact that even though they jump around in the timeline a lot, it was kind of fairly easy to keep track of, okay, this is when Scott was alive. This is Lisey sort of just talking to Scott in her head. And, you know, then very clearly this is Scott's childhood. And then you have, you know, Booyah Moon. So you obviously have that different dynamic where you kind of know what's real, but you also kind of don't, because there's just a bunch of things like in the background that aren't really ever pointed out or touched upon. And you're like, why is that person shrouded and stuff? And they don't really tell you. And, you know, then you have the long boy who is sort of this mystery until the end. You know, that's sort of when everything hits the climax and you're like, okay, here we go. We've arrived at this moment, finally.
Right. But even at the end, I liked this book, or excuse me, I liked that this film, because really this is one film released in 8 parts. This is not a TV show style thing. And of course, there's not going to be a second season, if you will, because where the hell would they go? But the film does not explain a lot of what's going on, like you said, and we get a little bit of it at the end. But then the long boy and why and how and what it's made of are never explained. Like, you can draw some inferences and your own conclusions, but it never explicitly lays out, like, this is why it looks like a bunch of writhing bodies stuck together in a vague beast shape. You know, that's never really talked about. And I liked that part because it doesn't matter to the story.
Yeah. The main criticism I was seeing throughout this was that the story felt kind of bogged down and it was too slow. And, you know, it really does seem like this got a lot of mixed reviews. And I don't really know if the book is the same way, but I understand why this story in particular is going to be very hit or miss. You have a lot of violence towards women in this. You have Amanda self-harming herself, and there's just so much that is just kind of really heavy subject matter in this. So it's completely understandable if you watched this and you didn't particularly enjoy it, because, you know, despite how good it looked and how great Julianne Moore's performance was, for a lot of people, that's probably not going to be enough. And I think that's totally okay.
I was only able to watch part of this with my husband, and I really wanted to watch the whole thing with him because he's never read the book. And I really wanted to get some perspective about how you would react to this if you hadn't read the book. Like, if you're just scrolling through Apple Plus and you're like, oh, Stephen King? Yeah, that sounds interesting. I'll give it a shot. You know, you've maybe read a couple books or seen a couple movies. How would this play out for you? Because I knew what was coming, and about third episode in, I was like, okay, we're going to stick pretty close to the story here. And what's going to change isn't going to be a big enough of a deal to really affect the message and the tone and all of that. But I could see how if you hadn't read the book, it wouldn't be enough to keep you going through the whole thing. Like, if you've read it and you enjoyed the book, then yeah, this is something that's probably going to appeal to you. But the parts for me that I really loved were the parts that were so much more informed by the book, like her relationship with her sisters, which is really, it's not the main focus, because obviously her and Scott are the main focus, but it comes in a real close second.
Yeah, and the fact that it's nowhere near a perfect relationship by any means, there's all of this tension. Darla is always upset about something. Always.
Oh, God. And always sassy and snappy and always ready with a comeback of just like, you couldn't have just kept that one inside, maybe. Couldn't have just held that one in. Like, no, she's never going to hold it in. She's always going to say the most awkward response to you.
And Jennifer Jason Leigh pulls it off very, very well, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And you have that moment where, towards the end of this, they're concocting their plan to basically get rid of Jim. And you have Darla, who, like, doesn't really understand anything that's going on, because it's like Lisey and Amanda's little secret, basically, because Scott shared a lot of this stuff with Amanda as well. In fact, some of it before he even shared it with Lisey, it appeared. And they had this relationship that I didn't really recall from the book.
I don't think it's as much discussed in the book as it is in this. I think that it's alluded to, but in a more subtle way, like, because he does do the preparing for her visit to the hospital and,
right,
you know, brings her back the one time. Like, all of those items are in there, but it's really fleshed out in this story, I think.
And I think they had to show us that in order for everything between Lisey and Amanda at the end to really come full circle and work. And then, you know, Darla kind of gets the short end of the stick here, let's be honest, yeah, because she's like, I don't understand. You're explaining it, but I still don't understand. And, you know, you can tell that she's upset because she doesn't get it.
Yeah, it's totally true. And Darla doesn't really want to understand, I think, is how it's portrayed. She's just like, oh, can this just not? Can we not? I'd like to not right now, actually, throughout the whole thing.
She just wants it to be over with. And Lisey does, too. She's the one who was brutally beaten by this guy, and he keeps coming and, like, stalking her, and the professor ends up being completely useless. You know, he's kind of, yep, creepy at the beginning, and you're just like, you're very direct, this is too much. And then, yep, you know,
inappropriate.
Yeah. And then Jim just takes over and, you know, cranks that up to 1,000.
Yep. And the sisters kind of, they, each of them handles it very differently, but Darla is the one who seems the most in the real world and is the most like, this can't be true, you guys are messing with me, or you're feeding into her delusions. But she does prove herself in the end, because she's like, well, fuck it, I'm gonna do this anyway, I'm not gonna let my sisters die from this if I can stop it. But still, throughout it all, she's still very much herself. And that is delightful in a, like, I have an older sister who will never listen to any of my podcasts, so I can say this. Like, she and I have an often contentious relationship, and I could see that. I was like, this feels very familiar to me. Not that she's Darla or anything, but I could see the sisterly tensions in their rapport with each other, and it rang very true. And so I was able to really enjoy that. And I think Amanda, especially because she's the older sister, she's the oldest in this and is the one who the other two have to take care of instead of the other way around, was played really well between the three of them. Because you can see that even though Darla, like, just doesn't want to deal with any of this, she's still going to go and take care of Amanda and give Lisey shit for not, like, stepping up and trying. And Lisey is the one who's like, I just gonna ghost over here now because I have other stuff going on.
Yeah, I was kind of like, okay, this isn't something I can relate to as an only child, but this feels relatively accurate given the wild situation that's going on.
Yes, it was a very sibling accurate relationship. And the best part is that the three actresses have such great chemistry together, and each of them is able to play that role so perfectly. And it feels, from how they talk to each other and their body language and everything, like they've had this relationship their whole lives. And that's what really sells it and makes it work, I think, for me, in that, especially in the last couple episodes where they're really put to the test.
Yeah, they really are. And you see how hard they are both trying to get Amanda sort of back to reality, because Darla has no idea what's going on with her. Lisey doesn't at the beginning either, really. She kind of has to figure it out through the bull hunt.
Yep.
And you have her going through this thing mostly alone because of Amanda's state and because of Darla's disbelief. So you have her trying to do all of these things while the cops are kind of keeping an eye on her place, so she can't do anything too out in the open, which, given how big that house is and how massive that barn is, you know, pretty easy for her to just stay in there and not be bothered. But there's so much that she has to go through on her own that I think that's why Julianne Moore was able to shine in this.
Yes, because she has to, there's a lot of, it's her with one other person, or it's just her. Like, there's so much screen time where it's just Julianne Moore, and she's not even talking. She's just acting from her facial expressions, like, especially every scene where she goes swimming. Like, all of those scenes are fraught with a lot of emotion, in particular, the one where she uses it to get to Booyah Moon in the very last episode, and it really allows her to show off her insanely good acting chops and connect with the audience on a personal level, because she feels so genuine when she's having these emotional reactions. And it makes me, like, as I was watching, I was like, this is why I love Julianne Moore, because not everybody can do that.
And it's funny because in the 2013 Carrie, she didn't get the same kind of chance to shine. She had her moments for sure, and she was definitely good in the role of Margaret White. There were just so many other things going on with that movie that I was like,
right,
we didn't ask for a fourth Carrie movie.
No, nobody asked or wanted it. I mean, I'm sorry, Brian De Palma he won with that. That's all.
Yeah, I kind of feel like if there is one that is a clear cut, very, very well done movie, you should just leave it at that. Like, I understand wanting to redo The Shining for the obvious reasons. And right, they did it as a TV miniseries because of other reasons that I'm not as sure about. But, you know,
it doesn't work.
Even like the Pet Sematary remake, and it's like, just leave it be. This, I think they should just kind of leave it at this. I don't think this is one that people are going to be clamoring to give a remake to anytime soon. I don't think they're going to do a second season either, because it's like you said, where do you take it? But overall, I thought this was pretty solid.
Yeah, and I think King would put the kibosh on that. This is such a important story to him, even though obviously Lisey is not Tabitha. You know, there's a lot of similarities, because from what I remember when I've read about this in interviews with him, he talked about how Tabitha does have a lot of sisters. You know, she is obviously incredibly important to him for his writing style. He has said, like, this isn't my wife, but this is kind of a fictional representation of how my relationship with my wife has formed how I continue. Like, you know, she's obviously very supportive of him. She's his first reader and all of that stuff. And I think this feels authentic, even though it is fictional. So it's a really hard line to walk. But if anybody can walk it, it's King. And he manages to pull it off not once, but twice, because I think he does it fantastically in the book. And I think in this, he also manages to get across those same ideas, even in a completely different format, which for his writing, is obviously, his screenwriting is obviously not as successful as his novel writing. And there's a lot of different reasons for that, but it's still just a fact.
Yeah, but he's also still written things like The Langoliers, so.
Tommyknockers, okay? Here's my obligatory Tommyknockers reference. Like, he's still written shitty books, but he can still just really grab onto relationships with people, and that's where he excels. Like, it is about the relationship between all of those kids, and that's what drives it forward. You know, The Stand is about the relationships between all of these survivors, and that's what drives it forward. So it's kind of a, if a book from King isn't necessarily about the relationships that happen in it, it's usually not as good, is in my experience.
This definitely feels like the, oh no, this might be something Tabitha goes through if I die before her sort of thing.
Yes.
And he's almost done so on more than one occasion.
Right. And that's what, you know, when I was looking into it, this one, this story was inspired by, obviously, his car accident and her redoing his studio after the car accident, or after he got hit by the van. We'll just put it that way. Yeah. That's more true. And I know that, you know, when he lived in the house in Maine, it wasn't unusual for them to have really inappropriate fan visitors. There was one person who jumped the fence to go and go into their house, and how Tabitha responded to that helped inform this story to a certain extent. So there's a lot of personal in this.
If I'm not mistaken, they had to move out of like that iconic Stephen King house and they lived like somewhere else in town.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the big reddish colored house is sort of the one that everyone takes the pictures of. It has like the wrought iron gate and everything.
I believe they donated it to the city.
Yeah. I think it's like one of those historical landmarks or something, that because it's also a very old house, like just the style of it.
Yeah. He lives, from my understanding, he lives half the time in like a more remote house in Maine. And then in the winters, he goes to Florida, which, hey, that's pretty normal. He's a snowbird like a lot of older Americans.
Yeah. Florida, though. Man, he must have fun there.
Right? I thought this worked for what it was trying to do. And because I'd already read the source material, I was prepared for it to be slow.
Same.
Because the book is pretty slow.
Yeah, I was actually surprised that, you know, when we talked about the book, I ended up liking it because of the fact that it took me like about a third of the way into the book to get into it.
And me too.
That's a long time to wait to get into a book. And I mean, I just went through that recently too with The Institute. It starts a little slow because you're not just diving right into the main part of the story. You're doing some setup that's going to come full circle later in that one. And, you know, not to give anything away in that one in case people haven't read it since it's more recent. But, you know, with Lisi's story, I did have one specific question for you. What did you think of the way they visualized how she went from, you know, reality to Booyah Moon?
The book leaves it pretty vague. So I was also wondering, like, how are they going to make this work? And I think the repeated visuals of water worked for me because, again, since I'd read the book, I didn't need an explanation for how it happens, because in the book, it just happens. She just opens her eyes and she's there. And that's a lot harder to pull off visually. In a book, you're far more willing to accept that stuff.
Yeah. In the book, it's like doing some hard thinking and then I'm there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm focusing my brain. And in this, I think the way that they did it worked for me because they used the same repeated visuals. And they do make mention of like what they're thinking about. You know, Scott tells her, focus on something in the room. Focus on something in the room. Think about the pool and that. And then they go into Booyah Moon, or they come back from Booyah Moon. So for me, it worked, but I can see how for some people it would feel like far too quick of a transition with no explanation of how you get there. So I liked it, but I'm the target audience type thing. How did you feel about it?
I think it worked because, like you said, they were consistent with it. And plus, that pool just looks amazing. I'm not a pool person by any means at all whatsoever.
And you grew up in Southern California, so.
Yes, I am aware.
I mean, if anybody's going to be into pools, you would think it'd be somebody who's been, you know, in the warm weather most of their life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, not a pool person at all. Not my thing. But it just fit in with the look of the house, the look of the barn and everything so well. And you were like, yes, this is a rich people pool. Like, you know, it kind of gave off that vibe.
It had to be a heated pool too, because that was definitely fall.
Yeah.
They are. I saw the color changing leaves and I was like, that's a heated pool, because there's no goddamn way anybody's going to, because I live in Minnesota and it has a pretty similar climate to Maine. You ain't getting in a pool after late September, if it's not heated.
Same goes for Colorado, probably.
Because it's just ice cold at that point. So, and there's none of the steam rising off of it that there would be in a heated pool in that situation. But, That was what I assumed, because otherwise it was just too uncomfortable to see her diving into the water. It was like, oh God, it's so cold.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been watching Chapelwaite advances, and there's like an ice bath scene, and I was like, that looks terrible.
Yep. I watched that in Atomic Blonde, and I was just like, ma'am, I know you're hurting, but good God, why are you doing that to yourself? Like, ugh.
Yeah. And for anyone who's listening to this now, we recorded this way in advance because we just kind of wanted to do it as close as possible to both of us finishing the show. So, you know, Katie, I finished this, I want to say about a month ago at this point, but there are still so many moments from this show that are very vivid in my mind, despite all of the other Stephen King stuff I've consumed in the last month. And I think it just goes to show that the cinematography did stand out in that way, because you and I have watched a lot of things where the cinematography stood out, but not for good reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this one is just absolutely amazing. Like, the use of color, the use of focus, how they filtered the film. Like,
yes.
And let's not forget the music. The score for this is amazing, and it works so well. And the cinematography was done by Darius Conji, and I might be pronouncing that person's last name wrong, and if so, I apologize. But I can't believe how well they pulled that off. I mean, I know this is Apple TV, which should be the equivalent of like an HBO or Showtime or something. So they dumped a lot of money into this, but it's still sometimes so surprising to see a television show or a miniseries, especially a Stephen King miniseries, which are rarely given the money that they need,
yeah,
to look so great and to have the visuals, even of the Long Boy. Because that's a pretty difficult
visual
CGI. Yeah. Yeah. Like, the visuals on that, they don't do a lot of it. They do it right in that they keep it dark most of the time, but then they spent the right amount of money on those few scenes where you are actually seeing the Long Boy up close and personal. And they spent their money wisely, I think, on this. And for me, it was like, I was pretty skeptical, honestly, of Apple TV. I was like, this sounds like a real Quibi type thing here.
So was this the first Apple TV Plus thing you had watched?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. I have been watching some of the other shows, and I think you'll like a couple other things. Like, Truth Be Told was with Octavia Spencer, and, you know, she was playing a podcaster and, you know, solving this sort of mystery because the person in jail was not guilty of it, you know?
So
it was that sort of vibe. Same deal, though. Very polished, great cinematography. One that I've really loved, though, is Home Before Dark, which is, it's based on a true story of this young girl who was like a journalist when she was like 9. And she was just like going out and stirring stuff up to find out the truth about things. And it's like, it's small town murder mystery stuff, which I think is safe to say is very much your vibe too.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I do have an 8-year-old little girl too. Yeah. So like,
yeah,
I'm picturing my own 8-year-old going out and stirring up stuff, and I can totally see it. I would never allow it, but I can totally see it.
Yeah. That has 2 seasons now. Very fun. And another thing they've been really good at with these Apple shows are just the settings, you know, like Amanda's house just being like by itself and amazing, you know,
and very color coded. Like, yes, color is important in this. And those little, like, it's mostly white, but then those little dashes of red and then the green on the doors is perfect to make it feel like this very remote place, even though I don't think it's that way in the book. But in the, and they never really show like the neighborhood it's in. We only see the house by itself.
Because it's on so much land. It's like there's nothing else in the shot. Even if you tried, there would be nothing else in the shot.
Right. And it feels so appropriate for a woman who experiences catatonia, because, you know, that symptom, because it's usually a symptom of a greater issue, is all about alone, being alone in your own head. And that feels very appropriate for her to live in a place where she is alone in reality, not just in her own mind.
Very alone. Like, you can't even hail a neighbor.
Right? Right? You can yell and no one's coming to help you.
No. Which is terrifying when you think about it, too, especially for, yes, someone like Amanda. And you then have, you know, Lisi and Scott's house, which another big, amazing looking house. The barn is just fantastic. Those bookshelves, I love
right?
all the bookshelves.
Oh, so jealous. I was like, oh my God. The thing I really understood from seeing that is the process that it is of cleaning out a house, like, and for her, Scott's study. And I have had recently I had losses in my personal life where I've lost friends and then seen their places get cleaned out. And it's incredibly difficult and painful for the people who've lost them. And it really hits home watching her pack things up and how over the course of the show, it goes from being a full-on study that you could see someone sitting down and writing at the desk to the end where it's completely empty, except for just a few last things. And I love how they made that work and how they used that set to illustrate the change that's going on in Lisey's life.
Yeah, it was just so good all around with how everything looked in this. I was really impressed. Even details down to like the little bathroom in the barn, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where we see the sink overflowing over and over again.
Yeah, and just things like that. And even their first apartment together that wasn't tiny, but for them, it felt cramped. I was like, I could live in a place like that, you know?
Yeah, right? If it was just me and a partner, hell yeah, I could live in a place like that. Like, it was gorgeous with all those, like, marble or those weird thick pane windows and amazing clock.
Yeah. What? But for them,
you got that clock at a thrift store, didn't you?
Yeah.
There's no way you could afford that new.
For them, it was almost like Scott's baggage kind of made them outgrow it faster. Like, they needed a little more privacy, you know, they needed a place where he couldn't just walk down to the laundromat and start punching the window, you know, like,
right.
They sort of needed their own space. And obviously, he was a very successful writer, so they were able to have that eventually. But I do like that they kind of showed the beginning stages of their relationship. And then, you know, the honeymoon at the Shining-esque, you know, hotel in the snow there. But yeah, I liked this. Didn't love it, but I thought it was a solid outing. So is there anything else you want to mention before we dive into ratings?
I think we covered it all. We were pretty detailed about this one. And I think it, you know, to get into the ratings, for me, I think I did love this. And I think I'll watch it again.
I might have to watch The Long Boy devour Jim again.
Yeah, that's a very satisfying scene. And they really stretch it out. And I was, thank you. Usually I'm fine with the bad guy just ending quickly. But yeah. In this, I was like, yeah, he needs to suffer.
That wasn't the stretching out we didn't enjoy.
Right, exactly. Especially after what, because during the violence scenes, I also did appreciate that, like you said, there was a lot of misogyny and male violence on women's bodies in this, but they do it very well in the same way that Stephen King does with his writing, in that you know it's happening, but they do not show it happening generally. Like in the scene where he beats the crap out of her and then cuts her up with the pizza slicer, which I was also like, no pizza slicer is that sharp, okay? Mm-mm, that's a lie. You ain't cutting nobody's skin with a pizza slicer. But we see the aftermath, but never the violence itself. And that, I think, is a good choice when you are condemning that violence. It never revels in what's happening. It only shows it as a terrible thing. The violence that we do see that happens is with Scott's dad.
Yeah.
And I think they have to show that violence for us to understand just how messed up that situation is. So it worked how they mixed that aspect of the story.
Yeah, not that violence against children or self-harm are any better than violence against women by any means, but they did pick and choose, I think, based on what we truly needed to see. Like, we needed to see what Amanda was doing to herself in order to understand just how deep she was into this trance-like state that she was in. And, you know, I probably give this a 3.5 out of 5. Better than fine, not A-plus material. You know, I think, you know, 7 out of 10, 3.5 out of 5, that's still good.
I think I might even, it's definitely a 4, maybe even a 4.5. And that might partially be because I'm willing to give it extra points, quote unquote, if you will, because so often Stephen King adaptations are so bad.
That's fair. I did debate on leaning more towards a 4. So I think I'm like very
putting
much
a thumb on the scale
in that 3.5, 4 sort of territory. But I think because I do think that it could have been like 2 episodes shorter. Like that's sort of the biggest knock from me on it is that it definitely was a little too slow. But I knew it was going to be. So
because I was talking to my husband about it and I was like, I'm pretty sure this is the best adaptation I've seen in that it's the best adaptation that tells the story as King initially wrote it. Like The Shining is amazing. It's an amazing film, a classic. But it is a terrible adaptation of a Stephen King story.
I keep saying that. Like, it really is.
But it's a good interpretation, a bad adaptation, I would say. But something like It, both of the It movies, but the miniseries and the 2 movies that they recently made, both have some serious shortcomings with the interpretation of the work. And they're bad adaptations of, like, one for one. Whereas this manages to be both a good adaptation of the material and a good interpretation of the material. And that's really hard. So I was willing to like, I think I like this more because it captures the original essence of that story so well. So that's why I gave it a little extra.
That's totally fair. And, you know, I love The Shining as well. I love the 2017 It movie. I don't like Chapter 2 as much. I will say that right now, you know.
The same. I liked the first one. The second one was not as good.
Yeah. Something like Stand By Me. I really love coming of age stories. So I think that's where some of the adaptations shine, especially that first It movie, because it just focuses on the kids. And let's be honest, It is never going to get a one-to-one adaptation, probably.
Nobody wants, and I don't want that. I'm gonna be clear, I don't want that.
There's some stuff from the book that it does not need to be in there. But I think I agree with you that Lisey's story is a very good adaptation in that sense, that it is so faithful to the source material. And it is, you know, a tough one. It's kind of like watching Gerald's Game.
Yes, which I know you watched recently. And that's another really great adaptation from book to screen.
And I like that one more on a rewatch. So I don't know if this has like a high rewatchability factor for me because it is 8 episodes and it would take a while. And, you know this. I'm sure some of the listeners know this. I'm not huge on rewatching stuff, especially if it's like not super exciting, because something can be good and not necessarily need to be exciting the entire time, which I think is the category this falls under. There are just certain things that are bad but rewatchable, like Maximum Overdrive, you know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
There's this whole thing I'm doing where I'm going through and I'm putting down like my star ratings from Letterboxd and Goodreads. I'm incorporating like a rewatchability factor and how much fun I had. And then I'm going to like do this master ranking list because I have lost my mind, Katie.
Yeah, you have lost your mind with that because it's like there's so much of his work. But I agree that rewatchability is something that you should consider with it because.
Yeah.
And in the same with the books, the rereadability of it, because there are King books. And the weirdest ones, I'm gonna be clear here. The one I've probably reread the most, other than either It or The Shining, is Insomnia. I love Insomnia. I think it's really fantastic.
Interesting. I don't think I like that one as much. I don't recall if you and I were the ones who discussed it. I think we might have been. You've been on a lot of episodes. I kind of lose track.
I think that was one of the ones I was like, I really want to talk about this one, though, because it's my favorite. Because it's mostly because it's about old people. And we so rarely get interesting stories about old people from someone who is not an old person. As in, I'm not an old person. So it's much harder for me to relate to that kind of experience.
Yeah.
But that book captures it really well. So I'll reread it. But, you know, something like Desperation, I will never reread that book. Still good book. But I just don't want to go through that again. It was too much.
Not a place we want to revisit. And, you know, I've been revisiting some of the more recent shows because I watched them when they were out, or, you know, they had come out just before I started doing this podcast. So I had already watched them and I was like, oh, I'm not going to remember all of these details 3 years from now. So, you know, I've been rewatching Castle Rock. I'm rewatching The Outsider and a few of the more recent things. And, you know, now that I have all of the source material information, obviously Castle Rock, not a direct adaptation of any one thing. It's like, here's the sandbox, play in it. But
right. But there's a couple episodes in that show, like the episode about dementia, that is just wow.
Yes.
Some of the best I've seen, honestly.
Yeah. Sissy Spacek kills it again. No surprise.
Always. Yep, always. That woman hasn't won as many Oscars as Meryl Streep is a crime.
But I think with Lisi's, it is a very, very good adaptation. It just might not be the kind of story that pace-wise translates super well to the small screen. You know, they could have maybe done like a 2.5 hour feature film and still managed to make it work, but that would have been tough. So I think 6 episodes might have been like the sweet spot for me personally with this story. But, you know, 8 episodes, if you haven't seen it, we've definitely spoiled all of it. But
yeah,
you know, I think it's still worth watching and coming to your own conclusions, because this one is intensely personal to King and it shines through in this adaptation.
Yeah, it's very emotional, and I think it works because, like I said, I lost 2 friends over the past year, none to COVID, but bad enough. And for me watching this, it was, you know, I'm watching my best friend go through losing her partner, and for me watching it on screen was a little cathartic. So I could see how if this isn't something that I would introduced to her for at least another 5 to 10 years. And that I think speaks to how affecting it could be for someone who's gone through that experience, because I think it would just hit too close to home seeing people going through the same loss, because that part of it does feel very real in how Lisi is dealing with grief. So I think even if you're not necessarily into King, if you've had something like that, it might, which I don't know why you'd be listening to this podcast if you're not into Stephen King, but just realize that.
You can if you want to, but I mean, I don't know
absolutely.
Why.
Yeah, I don't know how you would have picked this episode, but I think it'll still work for people, even with all the spoiling, because this isn't really a story that's about spoilers.
It's not about what happens by the end of it. It's about the entire journey that Lisi goes through. And I think that is way more important than anything that happens to close out this season, really, aside from her sort of being able to finally move on because she has decided to donate his works to a university or something. And, you know.
Yep, the University of Maine, not the university that the professor was from.
No, not at all.
Unsurprisingly.
Yeah, but I hope people do check this out. I know Apple TV Plus isn't the most popular service, but Katie, thank you so much for talking through this one with me.
Thank you for having me. This one I was really excited to talk about with you because it was so interesting and we had discussed the book. So I was excited to talk about the differences.
Always fun chatting with you.